Section 2, The Watergate Scandal, An American Story. As Bob Woodward, a young reporter for the Washington Post, sat in a Washington, D.C. courtroom on the morning of June 17, 1972, he was in a rather foul mood. His editor had ruined his Saturday by calling him in to cover a seemingly insignificant but bizarre incident. In the early hours of that morning, five men had broken into the Democratic National Committee, or DNC, headquarters in the city's Watergate apartment office complex. Woodward sat toward the back of the courtroom, listening to the bail proceedings for the five defendants. At one point, the judge asked each man his occupation. One of the men, James McCord, answered that he was retired from government service. "Where in government?" asked the judge. CIA, McCord whispered. Woodward sprang to attention. Why was a former member of the Central Intelligence Agency involved in what seemed to be nothing more than a burglary? Over the next 2 years, Woodward and another reporter, Carl Bernstein, would investigate this question. In doing so, they uncovered a scandal that helped bring about a grave constitutional crisis and eventually forced the president to resign. Adapted from All the President's Men. The Roots of Watergate. The scandal known as Watergate originated from the Nixon administration's attempts to cover up its involvement in the break-in at the Democratic National Committee, or DNC, headquarters, along with other illegal actions committed during Nixon's re-election campaign. While the affair began with the burglary at the Watergate complex, a number of scholars attribute the scandal in large part to the character of Richard Nixon and the atmosphere that he and his advisors created in the White House. Nixon and his enemies. Richard Nixon had fought hard to become president. He had battled back from numerous political defeats, including a loss to John Kennedy in the 1960 presidential election, to win the presidency in 1968. Along the way, however, Nixon had grown defensive, secretive, and often resentful of his critics. In addition, Nixon had become president during a time when the United States was still very much at war with itself. Race riots and protests over the Vietnam War continued to consume the country. In Nixon's view, these protesters and other radicals were out to bring down his administration. Nixon was so consumed with his opponents that he compiled an enemies list, filled with people from politicians to members of the media, whom he considered a threat to his presidency. Mounting a re-election fight. As Nixon's re-election campaign got underway in 1972, many in his administration expressed optimism about winning a second term. The president had just finished triumphant trips to China and the Soviet Union. In May, former Alabama Governor George Wallace, who had mounted a strong third-party campaign in 1968, had dropped his bid for another run at the White House after an assassin's bullet paralyzed him. Meanwhile, Nixon's Democratic opponent, South Dakota Senator George McGovern, was viewed as too liberal on many issues. At the same time, Nixon's hold on the presidency was uncertain. Despite the high approval ratings for the president's summit meetings in Beijing and Moscow, the unpopular Vietnam War still raged. Nixon staffers also remembered how close the margin of Nixon's 1968 victory had been. Seeking to gain an edge in every way they could, Nixon's team engaged in a host of subversive tactics, from spying on opposition rallies to spreading rumors and false reports. These tactics included an effort to steal information from the Democratic Party's headquarters. In the early hours of June 17, 1972, five Nixon supporters broke into the party's office at the Watergate complex in Washington, D.C. They had intended to obtain any sensitive campaign information and to place wiretaps on the office telephones. While the burglars were at work, a security guard making his rounds spotted a piece of tape holding a door lock. The guard ripped off the tape, but when he passed the door later, he noticed that it had been replaced. He quickly called police, who arrived shortly and arrested the men. The cover-up begins. In the wake of the Watergate break-in, the media discovered that one of the burglars, James McCord, was not only an ex-CIA official, but also a member of the Committee for the Re-election of the President, or CRP. reports soon surfaced that the burglars had been paid to execute the break-in from a secret CRP fund controlled by the White House. As questions swirled about a possible White House connection to the burglary, the cover-up began. Administration officials destroyed incriminating documents and provided false testimony to investigators. Meanwhile, President Nixon stepped in. While the president may not have ordered the break-in, he did order a cover-up. With Nixon's consent, administration officials asked the CIA to intervene and stop the FBI from inquiring into the source of the money paid to the burglars. Their justification was that such an investigation would threaten national security. All the while, the White House strongly denied any involvement in the break-in. Nixon's press secretary dismissed the incident as a third-rate burglary attempt, while the president himself told the American public, "The White House has had no involvement whatever in this particular incident." The strategy worked. Most Americans believed President Nixon. Despite efforts by the media, in particular the Washington Post, to keep the story alive, few people paid much attention to the Watergate affair during the 1972 presidential campaign. On Election Day, Nixon won re-election by one of the largest margins in history with nearly 61% of the popular vote, compared to 37.5% for George McGovern. The electoral vote was 520 votes for Nixon and 17 for McGovern. Reading check. Examining. Why did members of the CRP break into the Democratic National Committee headquarters? The cover-up unravels. Shortly after his triumphant re-election, an exuberant and confident Nixon told his cabinet and staff that 1973 can be and should be the best year ever. In a matter of months, however, the Watergate affair would erupt, and the coming year would be one of the president's worst. The first cracks show. In 1973, the Watergate burglars went on trial. Under relentless prodding from federal judge John J. Sirica, McCord agreed to cooperate with both a grand jury investigation and with the Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities, which had been recently established under Senator Sam J. Ervin of North Carolina. McCord's testimony opened a floodgate of confessions, and a parade of White House and campaign officials exposed one illegality after another over the next several months. Foremost among the officials was counsel to the president, John Dean, a member of the inner circle of the White House who leveled allegations against Nixon himself. A summer of shocking testimony. In June 1973, John Dean testified before Senator Ervin's committee that former Attorney General John Mitchell had ordered the Watergate break-in and that Nixon had played an active role in attempting to cover up any White House involvement. As a shocked nation absorbed Dean's testimony, the Nixon administration strongly denied the charges. A standoff ensued for the next month as the Senate committee attempted to determine who was telling the truth. Then on July 16th, the answer appeared unexpectedly. On that day, White House aide Alexander Butterfield testified that Nixon had ordered a taping system installed in the White House to record all conversations. The president had done so, Butterfield said, to help him write his memoirs after he left office. For members of the committee, however, the tapes would tell them exactly what the president knew and when he knew it. The case of the tapes. All the groups investigating the scandal sought access to the tapes. Nixon refused, pleading executive privilege, the principle that White House conversations should remain confidential to protect national security. A special prosecutor appointed by the president to handle the Watergate cases, Archibald Cox, took Nixon to court in October 1973 to force him to give up the recordings. Nixon, clearly growing desperate, ordered Attorney General Elliot Richardson and then Richardson's deputy to fire Cox. Both men refused and resigned in protest. Solicitor General Robert Bork finally fired Cox, but the incident, nicknamed the Saturday Night Massacre in the press, badly damaged Nixon's reputation with the public. The fall of 1973 proved to be a disastrous time for Nixon for other reasons as well. His vice president, Spiro Agnew, was forced to resign in disgrace. Investigators had discovered that Agnew had taken bribes from state contractors while he was governor of Maryland, and that he had continued to accept bribes while serving in Washington. Gerald Ford, the Republican leader of the House of Representatives, became the new vice president. Nixon then had to defend himself against allegations about his own past financial dealings. Government. Nixon resigns. In an effort to quiet the growing outrage over his actions, President Nixon appointed a new special prosecutor, Texas lawyer Leon Jaworski, who proved no less determined than Cox to obtain the president's tapes. In April 1974, Nixon released edited transcripts of the tapes, claiming that they proved his innocence. Investigators felt otherwise and went to court again to force Nixon to turn over the unedited tapes. In July, the Supreme Court ruled that the president had to turn over the tapes themselves, not just the manuscripts. With nowhere else to appeal, Nixon handed over the tapes. Several days later, the House Judiciary Committee voted to impeach Nixon, or officially charge him of presidential misconduct. The committee charged that Nixon had obstructed justice in the Watergate cover-up, misused federal agencies to violate the rights of citizens, and defied the authority of Congress by refusing to deliver tapes and other materials that the committee had requested. The next step was for the entire House of Representatives to vote whether or not to impeach the president. As the nation held its collective breath in anticipation, investigators finally found indisputable evidence against the president. One of the unedited tapes revealed that on June 23, 1972, just 6 days after the Watergate burglary, Nixon had ordered the CIA to stop the FBI's investigation of the break-in. With this news, even the president's strongest supporters conceded that impeachment and conviction in the Senate now seemed inevitable. On August 9, 1974, Nixon resigned his office in disgrace. Gerald Ford took the oath of office and became the nation's 38th president. Reading check. Explaining. What was the significance of John Dean's testimony before the Senate committee? The impact of Watergate. Upon taking office, President Ford urged Americans to put the Watergate affair behind them and move on. "Our long national nightmare is over," he declared. The effects of the scandal, however, endured long after Richard Nixon's resignation. The Watergate crisis prompted a series of new laws intending to limit the power of the executive branch. In the 1970s, Congress passed a number of laws aimed at reestablishing a greater balance of power in government. The Federal Campaign Act amendments limited campaign contributions and established an independent agency to administer stricter election laws. The Ethics in Government Act required financial disclosure by high government officials in all three branches of government. The FBI Domestic Security Investigation Guidelines restricted the Bureau's political intelligence gathering activities. After Watergate, Congress also established a means for appointing an independent counsel to investigate and prosecute wrongdoing by high government officials. Despite these efforts, Watergate left many Americans with a deep distrust of their public officials. Speaking some 20 years after the Watergate affair, Alexander Haig, a former high-level Nixon aide, said the scandal had produced a fundamental discrediting of respect for the presidency and a new skepticism about politics in general, which every American feels to this day. On the other hand, some Americans saw the Watergate affair as proof that in the United States, no person is above the law. As Bob Woodward observed, Watergate was probably a good thing for the country. It was a good, sobering lesson. Accountability to the law applies to everyone. The problem with kings and prime ministers and presidents is that they think they are above it, and there is no accountability, and that they have some special rights and privileges and status. And a process that says, no, we have our laws and believe them, and they apply to everyone, is a very good thing. Quoted in Nixon, An Oral History of His Presidency. After the ordeal of Watergate, most Americans attempted to put the affair behind them. In the years ahead, however, the nation encountered a host of new troubles, from a stubborn economic recession to a heart-wrenching hostage crisis overseas. Reading check. Evaluating. Why did Congress pass new laws after the Watergate scandal?